European descent named Michael Coleman. Or maybe you don't remember him. Because, listener, I have not yet told you all that much about him. Sure, I've alluded to him here and there. My boyfriend, my fiancé, Michael. But what more could you be expected to know? Listener, you should know that he is a comedy writer. This information will come in handy in about two paragraphs. But you should also know this. Like many couples, Michael Coleman and I dated for several years before we got married. And yet, at the time of this whirlwind week of mine, Michael and I happened to have been on what is commonly known as a break. We thought that we might be better off as friends. We couldn't have been more wrong! Nonetheless, at the time, we thought that we were right, and we continued to talk on the phone as friends almost daily. And so, when I arrived at 30 Rock the afternoon of my meeting with Lauren Michaels, I called someone who also had Michael in his name. Michael. Michael, I whispered on the phone just before entering the turnstile to get on the elevator. I am about to meet with Lauren Michaels in his office. I could hear my friend Michael sniffle. He paused. I imagined that his emotions must be engulfing him and that he was overcome with happiness for me. I opened my mouth to tell him that I was fine, that I would calm down, but he spoke first. "That's amazing, Elle," he croaked. I smiled, instantly soothed. "I think I'm getting a cold," Michael went on. "Oh, Cupid, you devil, you." Though Michael was battling some mild summer sneezes that particular afternoon, he made a masterful recovery in the days to come. And he spent endless hours speaking to me on the phone about characters, monologues, bits, and other ideas for my audition. We met for coffee, lunch, and one evening a pie. From a comedy standpoint, his help was invaluable. And as a friend, Michael was as supportive as someone possibly could be. At one point over a bad omelet at the Village Den, I realized that I was no longer concerned with the outcome of my SNL audition. I just felt very happy that Michael was in my life. But then I left the diner to get on the subway and realized that if I didn't absolutely nail this audition, I would kill myself. I knew the day that I was auditioning, Thursday, August 7th, but I did not find out the exact time until that morning. At 10 a.m., my manager emailed to say that I should arrive at 30 Rock at 4, but that my audition wouldn't be for a while after that. Their hair and makeup department would get us ready. We would fill out paperwork, and then we would wait. I decided to arrive by 2, a full 2 hours early, you know, just to be safe. Before getting on the train, I bought a turkey and cheese sandwich from Fairway. I sat down on a bench outside the grocery store and began to eat. As I was opening my mouth to take a second bite, I noticed that tucked away inside the folds of smoked turkey was a dead grasshopper. A grasshopper. If you know anything about life or omens or insects, you will know that a grasshopper is the universal symbol of good luck. I threw my head back and laughed with all the joy there was to have in this world. Then I smashed the grasshopper repeatedly with my foot and threw the sandwich into the street. I mean, I'd almost just eaten a grasshopper. Disgusting! I dug through my backpack until I found a squashed s'mores Luna bar, made sure there weren't any bugs in it, and headed for the train. As soon as I arrived at 30 Rock, I went to the hair and makeup room on the 8th floor. After that, I was led to a large, windowless room where I filled out what must have been 45 minutes worth of paperwork. Then I sat in a chair next to maybe 18 other actors. I knew Nate Lang and John Mulaney from UCB, but I didn't recognize anyone else. Maybe they were from L.A. or Chicago? Had they also referred to Lauren Michaels as Michael Lawrence? There was no way to know for sure. Eventually, someone led us downstairs, one by one, to a dressing room outside the studio. Because commentary on the 2008 Summer Olympics was being broadcast from the SNL studios in 8H, we auditioned in Late Night with Conan O'Brien's studio in 6A. 6A! A familiar face at last. I'd only been in that studio a handful of times doing bits on Conan, but it was reassuring to be in a space that felt, well, not quite like home, but like a studio I'd performed in a few times before. John Mulaney auditioned just ahead of me. We passed each other in the narrow hallway between the stage and the main floor, and he told me that he felt like all energy had just left his body. He was done. I was next. I would be able to feel like all energy had just left my body in a matter of minutes. I was in the home stretch. I performed 5 characters that evening. My 2 celebrity impressions were Miley Cyrus and Renee Zellweger, and my 3 showcase characters were Miss Sullivan, a terrified substitute teacher, Taya, an eccentric frozen yogurt server, and Mary, a woman on a trip in Tahiti, breaking up with her husband back home in Pennsylvania. I had come up with the characters of both Taya and Mary that week. And suddenly, just like that, my audition was over. All I remember is that the lights in the audience were not dimmed. I could see Lorne Michaels and the 5 or 6 other people sitting there, and there was pleasant laughter throughout my audition. In fact, though everyone warns you beforehand that no one will laugh during your audition, I have never spoken to any person who has auditioned for SNL who has experienced this. That's right. Even the brass enjoys a chuckle, guys. I left the building feeling drained. I was so tired. All energy and any reserves had indeed been completely zapped from my system. But do you know what often saves you when energy cannot? A crazy little thing called love. That same night, a bunch of Conan writers were meeting up at Hurley's, a 3-floor saloon. Michael had texted me to see how the audition went and invited me to join them. Listener, I married him. 4 years later. That night, I met him at Hurley's. The Conan gang and Michael and I shared some brews and classic pub grub, and when I finally fell asleep that night, I felt very happy. Not only because if I ever met with Lorne Michaels again, I would know exactly what era of SNL I had grown up on. Wayne's World. But also because somebody else must have paid for our appetizers. I never got a bill, and no bartender stopped me on the way out. Mostly, though, I was happy because I had spent the evening laughing with Michael. But I never did hear back from Saturday Night Live, so I'm guessing I didn't get the part. Hulk. One Sunday morning in the spring of 2010, my then-boyfriend, now-husband, Michael and I went to a very healthy, very hip restaurant in NoHo. NoHo, for those listeners not from New York City, is the area north of Houston Street. See what they did there? Technically, it should be called NoHo-st, I guess, but nobody would really know how to pronounce that. And besides, then we wouldn't be able to say ho and get away with it. Besides saying ho and giggling afterward, I also used to really love brunch. I now understand that brunch is either just breakfast or it is just lunch, depending on what you order. Nobody came up with any new items for this concept. Everyone just puts everything on the menu at once, and we all call ahead to try to get a table before being told that they do not take reservations. Anyway, to every meal there is a season, and in the spring of 2010, I still slept past 6 a.m. on weekends. I did not realize that lemon ricotta pancakes cost twice as much but taste just the same as regular pancakes when smothered in syrup. And neither Michael nor I was quite out of our, "Can you believe we actually live in the same city as the girls from Sex and the City? I'm a Miranda" phase. Michael was, is, a Miranda. I was, am, a Carrie. For these reasons, we spent that Sunday morning eating brunch. While not a certifiable health nut, I do genuinely like wholesome meals, preferring to save my indulgences for normal late-night desserts. Traditional treats, like an entire bear and a half of Stouffer's animal crackers, eaten alone on the floor with the lights off and the shades drawn. So, for this brunch, I selected the entree titled quinoa and lentils. While the fine print below read, delicata squash, sautéed greens, house-made burrata, and poached egg, I figured the 2 primary ingredients of quinoa and lentils would be quinoa and lentils. I like both of these foods, and I offer this in my defense. I was looking forward to eating them. As our waiter walked away and Michael and I tucked into the New York Times, for him, the book review, for me, pretending to read the front page while wishing it was a word jumble, a young couple sat next to us. I thought I recognized the woman as the little sister of someone I went to high school with, but I wasn't sure. She never looked my way, and I wondered if I had the disorder where you can't recognize people's faces. Then I went back to wishing I had a word jumble. About 10 minutes later, a different waiter brought our food. I knew this not because of what must have been his different face, But because, unlike our first waiter, this man smelled like a vanilla cake. It was heavenly, and exactly how I imagined Giselle Bundchen must smell. As he walked away, I noticed there was something missing from my quinoa and lentils. The lentils. I rubbed my eyes and squinted like I was a cartoon character. No lentils. I saw greens. I saw burrata. I saw poached egg. I even saw what I could only presume was the squash, being very fine and very fragile in appearance. And it suddenly became clear to me that delicata must mean delicate in a foreign language. But I realized I no longer cared about words. Where were the lentils? What in the world? I hissed, slamming my fist on the table and grabbing Michael by the collar. Look at this food, I snarled, yanking his face toward my plate. My future husband struggled to break free, but my hold was too strong. I ordered a dish with lentils, Michael. But do you see any lentils? Michael pleaded with me. Let me go, Ellie. I didn't make the food. I'm sure it was a misunderstanding. I know that we can straighten this out. Just please, let me go. I bared my teeth at him and growled. Fine, I said. Fine, Michael. I shoved his face away and punched the air. But some wise guy is gonna pay for this. The truth is, I tend to get flustered when I'm hungry, or when a meal isn't what I thought it was going to be. One time, when I was 17, my sister Carrie and I took our 9-year-old brother Billy to dinner at TGI Fridays in the St. Louis Galleria. I think that my parents had gone out for the evening, so we assumed this would be a fun thing to do. Assumed is right. The ass was made not only of you and me, but of Billy and Carrie, too. Our food didn't arrive for more than an hour after we ordered. 20 minutes in, I put my head down on the table and told Carrie to wake me up when the meal came. I knew that if I didn't calm my mind in that moment, I might grow violent. When Billy started in on some story about soccer practice, I grabbed his hand. Billy, my boy, I said, trying very, very hard to be gentle with my little baby brother. I need you not to talk. I took Carrie's hand, too. I need there to be complete silence while my head is down. Billy looked at Carrie, who nodded. Carrie is the very portrait of patience, with an incredibly high threshold for pain. Once, during a game of hide-and-seek when Carrie was 4 or 5, she hid under a pop-up trundle bed in my room. Our neighbor Emily, the seeker, came along and sat on the bed, not knowing Carrie was underneath. But the bed was in the unlocked position, and it collapsed on top of Carrie. Determined to keep her hiding spot, Carrie lay quietly under the fallen bed, stoically enduring not only its weight, but the weight of Emily's gangly body as well. 20 minutes later, Emily finally caught sight of a small pink shoelace peeking out beneath the metal frame and yelped. I found you, Carrie, she shouted. Carrie stuck out her small hand and congratulated Emily on her win. Unfortunately, I share neither my sister's forbearance nor my younger brother's childlike wonder. In addition to getting angry when I am hungry, I also do not find it easy to adapt to changes in plans. And I had been counting on those lentils. I'm not sure I was wrong in doing that. The dish was named quinoa and lentils. Suddenly, the universe was spinning. For someone like me, changes like this are upsetting. I become unmoored, like a bird sitting in a tree and the tree is suddenly cut down, or a bird flying through the air and the air is suddenly filled with kites. I feel out of control, I panic, and I accidentally fly straight into a closed window. Plans, schedules, and structure make me feel secure in a world that, let's just say it, is going straight to hell. I have loved schedules for as long as I can remember. Back at brunch, I took a deep breath. I knew that you catch more flies with honey, and so I was ready to be a one-woman army of bees. I caught the eye of our original waiter, the one who didn't smell like vanilla cake, and waved. He walked over to our table, and I laid my hand gently on his arm. Is everything okay? He asked. I guess he wasn't used to customers touching him, and I quickly realized that was because it was totally inappropriate. I removed my hand. Everything's okay, I said softly, showing him the bowl. I think there are supposed to be lentils with this quinoa, but there's only quinoa. Well-trained, the waiter expressed concern and announced that he would go get his manager. This was not part of the plan. I noticed people beginning to look over. My initial outburst with Michael could have been described as stormy, but it had also been reasonably quiet. Now, the waiter's loud voice was getting the attention of my fellow patrons, and I imagined what they must be thinking. "Mom, today I saw a grown woman cry because she didn't get what she ordered at brunch," one of them would recount on an afternoon phone call home. "You've got to move out of New York City," this wise mom would reply. The only thing more embarrassing than losing your temper is losing your temper for all the world to see. Our waiter's pledge to get the manager, combined with my rapidly dropping blood sugar, was laying all the necessary groundwork for what you might call a scene. As though I were listening to a CNC Music Factory album from 1990, beads of perspiration started dripping from my armpits, trickling down my back, and soaking through my high-rise Hanes. I clung to the notion that I could still make honey. Remember how earlier I called myself a one-woman army of bees? And be nice. But the intestinal gas now forming as a result of having coffee on an empty stomach suggested otherwise. I was beginning to lose control. My legs trembled and I felt lightheaded. I looked at Michael, helpless. "What is happening to me?" I whispered, my mouth dry and my eyes large. "Michael, things are about to get ugly." My future husband held my gaze. "Baby, I am here for you," he declared, "but I do want to wash my hands before I eat." Michael then left for the bathroom. I tried some light breathing exercises, but I knew I had no idea what I was doing. I have read in many places that breathing can calm a person down, but I've also read that running will both extend your life and kill you prematurely. The point is, you can't believe everything you read. I think that's why I like word jumbles so much. With Michael gone, I had no one to turn to besides the waiter who smelled like cake. I waved him over and asked him to please go stop the first waiter from getting the manager. "Who is this other waiter?" he asked, hurt. But I couldn't answer. I could feel my muscles expanding, because the intestinal gas was stretching out my stomach. A button popped off my jeans, because my gassy stomach was so bloated. I was turning green, because I felt sick. I opened my mouth to speak, but a roar came out instead. Actually, it was just a grossly loud burp. I had reached Hulk status. A middle-aged woman approached the table. She did not smile. "I'm the manager. Is there a problem?" Her jaw was clenched and her eyes narrowed. The young lady at the table next to us, the one who I thought was the little sister of the girl I went to high school with, was now staring directly at me. And suddenly, my inability to recognize faces was cured. And I saw with absolute certainty that Deirdre Walsh, captain of the 2001 John Burroughs varsity swim team, would be a full witness to the fury flag I was about to let fly. "Hi, Deirdre," I shouted. "Do you live in New York now?" I turned back to the manager. I briefly closed my eyes and tried to envision a placid lake or a sunset in Tahiti. But all I could envision were lentils, quinoa, and birds falling out of the sky. "Yes, there is a problem," I said tightly. "There aren't any lentils in this quinoa and lentil dish." The manager looked down at my bowl. She picked up a fork and moved some things around. "See this?" she asked me, pointing to a teensy-weensy flake of food. "That's a lentil." She stared at me for a moment. "Lentils are disc-shaped legumes that come in all sorts of sizes and colors." And now we have reached the last of my three most adorable quirks. As we have already established, I get irritated when I'm hungry. I don't easily adapt to changes in plans. And finally, I don't like being sassed. I guess I don't know anyone who actually enjoys being sassed, as that is the whole point of sassing. The sasser seeks to weaken the sassy with his sass. But some people laugh off this pain. You've heard of the song, "The Tears of a Clown." This is all about the pain that people try to laugh off. But I don't try to laugh off pain. I try to get even. "Oh, I know what lentils look like," I said icily. I was smiling, but but it was the smile of a madwoman. I know that they are discs. What are you pointing to in here? She looked at me again and asked if she could use my spoon. I told her that she could. She then lifted out a tiny shell of a lentil, a sliver so small, you would be better off feeding it to a planarian. This is a lentil, she told me. I then saw that the dish was sprinkled with these little slivers, probably 2 dozen or so in total. So these are the lentils, my brain told me. This is what all the fuss has been about. At the end of the day, the lentils had been there all along. They just weren't what I was expecting. And suddenly, I was exhausted. I looked wearily at Deirdre Walsh and sighed. A lentil is never just a lentil, is it? But in this case, it really was, or wasn't. I thanked the manager for her help and told her that the dish wasn't quite what I had been expecting, but that it looked delicious all the same. Was some of me behaving well because I could see that the sunny blonde John Burroughs swimmer was watching and I didn't want her to tell everyone from home that I was psychotic? Yes. Was another part of me behaving well because, deep down, I knew that none of this really mattered? Also, yes. But was the greatest part of me behaving well so that everyone would just go away and I could finally put food in my face? Absolutely. Bride. I couldn't have known that morning on the elevator in 2005 that the stubbly man next to me, wondering aloud if almond croissants contain enough protein to make any difference, would end up as my husband. There was no way I could have guessed that the spectacled houseguest asking my mom if she was absolutely positive she had roasted the Thanksgiving turkey at a high enough temperature would become my life partner. How could I have predicted that the weepy guy beside me during the dark night,
"The Joker's henchman just threw the bomb off the boat in order to save people's lives," he sobbed. "He defied the Joker in the name of peace,"
would eventually be the father of my son. And yet, as we have recently established, love works in mysterious ways. Love was definitely on our side on July 7th, 2012, which is the day that Michael Komen and I got married, and also the day that I accidentally told Leo Rusnak that I loved him. I had not met Leo Rusnak until that night. He was an 84-year-old guest from the groom's side, but I was caught up in the spirit of things. I was overly excited, and Leo Rusnak happened to be at the right place at the right time. I'm not sure that my husband's 12-year-old self could have imagined this would be where he ended up. At that time, Michael was probably trying out his stand-up jokes on an audience of Mariana fruit bats. His parents had gotten divorced when he was 8, and his father had moved across the world to the island of Saipan, a U.S. commonwealth in the Western Pacific, several years later. Michael spent 4 summers there, from ages 12 to 16, and still speaks fondly of it. When I was 12, I had just starred as Kathy, a poor man's Rizzo, in our 6th grade production of Happy Valley High, a poor man's Grease. I had a crush on an inscrutable redhead named Adam Smith. I had just started using Clean and Clear spot treatment to stave off acne, and I couldn't wait for 9th grade so I could be a cheerleader. Michael started doing stand-up at the Comedy Store in La Jolla, California, while he was still a sophomore in high school. He was working at the club's front desk as a ticket taker when Fred Burns, the club's manager, asked him if he wanted to give stand-up a whirl. Michael said yes, and his first act was done entirely in a fake British accent. Art is complicated, and it is impossible to say where or how Michael came up with this character. He modestly claims it happened on a whim. Afterward, Michael returned home to binge-eat Snickers bars and binge-watch comedy movies, 20th Century, Road to Utopia, Sherlock Jr., until after midnight. In 10th grade, I played field hockey in the fall and ran track in the spring. I went to the blue and gold homecoming dance with Justin Cram. I got my driver's license in May, and I said no when offered pot at a U2 concert that summer. I was also really good at algebra, too. Michael and I are very different. I, for example, place great emphasis on manners, appearing engaged in social situations, and never letting there be lulls in conversations. Michael, in contrast, is extremely comfortable with blank facial expressions speaking quietly and unintelligibly, and lots of silence. My family belonged to a country club and took long summer road trips to visit my grandma and grandpa in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Michael went on cruises on the Black Sea with his mother and stepfather and was once babysat in La Jolla by a Mormon couple who built a healing pyramid over his bed with a crystal dangling from the apex. How will these two lovebirds meet, you wonder? We met when Michael was a 28-year-old writer at Late Night with Conan O'Brien and I was a 25-year-old intern. Thankfully, gainful employment was not something Michael seemed particularly concerned with in a companion. We became close pals, hanging out on weekends and going to improv shows and dinner. I told my mom that I wasn't sure if he had a crush on me or not. There certainly weren't any other guys in my life with whom I hung out so exclusively and so often. I sort of had a crush on Michael, but mostly I was glad to have such a good friend. Michael met my family in St. Louis before we were even dating. It was a cold and dreary autumn, and the great writer's strike of 2007 to 2008 was in full swing. Across the nation, writers from television and movies were seriously considering going out in the light winds and intermittent drizzle to picket, before deciding that eating lunch at a diner made more sense. Late Night always had shows over the Thanksgiving holiday. Michael was supposed to have been stuck in NYC working that week and unable to go home to San Diego, so his mother and stepfather had planned a trip to Europe. By the time the strike was announced, it was too late for them to cancel their trip, so I invited Michael to spend the holiday with my own family. This was odd, because Michael was not my boyfriend, nor was it characteristic of me to invite people to do things. I hadn't expected him to say yes when I invited him, but he did. The next thing I knew, he was sidling up to my dad, a banker and former high school football quarterback, asking him quietly if the tap water in St. Louis is safe to drink. I had introduced Michael as my friend, which he was, but I think my whole family was confused. Ellie, my mom said, as she mashed the potatoes and I watched. Are you two dating now? I considered the question. No, I replied. Think of him as Joe, I explained, referring to my best friend from college. Of course, Michael wasn't Joe. He was a man no one in my house had ever met who was now sleeping on an air mattress in Billy's room. Nonetheless, the visit went off without a hitch, though I think we all left that weekend wondering what exactly had just happened. It was on the eve of my breakthrough role as Sue, the negligent veterinarian's assistant in a training video for veterinarian assistants, that Michael and I decided we should start dating for real. Was Michael swept away by my performance as the crabby employee who didn't care about pets? Could have been. Whatever the reason, we clicked. And 3 years later, in August 2011, Michael proposed to me. We set our wedding date for the following July. I had never been a bride before, but I haven't been a lot of things before. Inexperience doesn't exactly intimidate me. While I hadn't grown up fantasizing about my wedding day, I also hadn't grown up thinking that I would marry anyone other than Ted Danson. My point is, fantasies and thoughts change over time, and also I used to have an enormous crush on Ted Danson, despite never having watched an entire episode of Cheers. I accepted my new role of bride with the dignity and grace it deserved. I knew that this undertaking would require a good deal of endurance, and I vowed, wedding pun, to take the planning process in stride. As you might have surmised by now, listener, I have a tendency to become, charmingly consumed by even the simplest of tasks, and I didn't want my wedding to become a mess of anxious meltdowns. Slow and steady wins the race, I thought to myself during a stress-reducing hike in L.A.'s Griffith Park. Be the tortoise bride, not the hare. And yet, even a sunny hike in a vast park where severed heads are occasionally found was not enough to bring me inner stillness. The truth is, I felt completely overwhelmed by the idea of planning a wedding. I knew that I wanted a traditional affair with a Catholic ceremony, but I also knew that the biggest party I had planned up until that point was the night I invited four friends over to watch the 2006 Oscars. A wedding would be a party on a different scale. There was no getting around it. Even if I were to keep the guest list to a minimum of family only, that would still be more than 5 dozen guests, all of them looking vaguely like Michael or me. The seemingly endless decisions before me. Meal selections, floral arrangements, venues, invitations. struck fear deep into my heart, and I began to panic. I realized that if I did not attempt to exist on a plane of utter and complete serenity, I would never be able to get through the process of planning my wedding without going crazy. And so I decided to enroll in a class on Transcendental Meditation, TM. I had first heard about TM from Michael himself. He had lived in Los Angeles in his early 20s, spending a great deal of time driving around in an old Jeep Wrangler, listening to Leonard Cohen, and meditating. In my early 20s, I had spent a great deal of time driving around in a champagne-colored Taurus, listening to Matchbox 20, and playing recreational field hockey. But even the powerful 90s hits, 3 a.m., and Push, failed to give me the kind of mystical stillness I was now seeking, so I decided to give TM a try. The basement of the Los Feliz TM Center I chose was warm, and there were always clementines around. At the very least, I thought, smiling to myself, you won't get scurvy. I had learned when I was just a girl that pirates at sea often suffered from scurvy due to a lack of vitamin C. And while I was more than ready to embrace the spirit of a pirate as I planned my wedding, let's bustle this dress, mateys! Arr! I was not ready to get sick from being deprived of fresh fruit. Put an eye patch on me and hand over the cutlass, sure, but don't you dare take away my vitamins! However, my TM class ended up being about much more than citrus. It ended up being about naps. While the class stretched a full 3 days, I had learned all that I was to learn within the first 10 minutes. The main lesson was my mantra, which I am not allowed to reveal here because the ruler of Transcendental Meditation forbids followers from ever sharing their mantras. As a hint, though, mine rhymes with phlegm. For the purposes of this story, let's just say that my mantra is phlegm. Here is what those crucial first 10 minutes taught me to do. I would inhale deeply and say phlegm in my head. Then I would exhale, but I wouldn't say phlegm. I would do all of this while sitting quietly with my eyes closed. If another thought entered my head while I was breathing and saying phlegm, I would acknowledge the thought, but not pay it any mind. Picture that thought like a little puppy dog nipping at you, my TM instructor advised us. Smile at the dog, but continue your walk. Even though I had never owned a pet, which is, incidentally, precisely why I was able to endow Sue from the veterinarian video with just the right amount of indifference, I was able to understand what my teacher was getting at. Ignore the thought, I thought to myself any time I started to get distracted by a random thought. Phlegm, I would think instead and breathe in. Then I would say nothing silently, but still breathe out. And then I would do it again for what felt like 20 minutes. Our instructor cautioned us against using an actual timer, after which I was supposed to slowly open my eyes and readjust to the real world. There was just one problem with closing my eyes and reciting this mantra. I soon began falling asleep within 2 or 3 minutes of closing my eyes. I'm not sure that's a huge surprise. I was in a warm room that smelled like oranges. Who wouldn't fall asleep under those circumstances? When I practiced at home, it was even worse. At first, I meditated on my bed, but quickly learned that was just asking for a nap. I tried sitting on the hardwood floor, but it turns out I could nap on that too. I tried the front seat of my car, the back seat of my car, an uncomfortable garden stool, and even standing up. But I was able to fall asleep in all of these locations. Have I officially reached nirvana? I had to wonder. Whenever a wedding task would come my way, I could feel my heart rate begin to rise. Slow down, I urged myself. Remember the mantra. And I would close my eyes, quietly say phlegm, then wake up anywhere between 15 minutes to 4 hours later. Elle, have you put together your guest list? My mom wrote one December afternoon. I'm attaching the names and addresses of friends Dad and I would like to invite. I smiled as I read my mom's email. I knew that the guests would come, whether notified or not. Guests have a way of figuring that sort of thing out. Don't worry, Mom, I wrote back. The guests will come. I'm not worried, she responded. I just want to make sure you invite my friends. I closed my eyes for a moment and said, phlegm. We've got this, I wrote to my mom. What? She said. Ellie, do you need help finding your dress? My sister asked me a few days later. I giggled. I had asked Carrie to be my maid of honor, but I feared she was getting too caught up in the minutiae. I'll be wearing a dress that day, I answered mysteriously. Right, she replied. Do you want me to go shopping with you? That could be fun. I laughed again and took her hand in mine. Stop worrying, I whispered, mostly to myself. Ellie, are we signed up for pre-Cana? Michael asked me one weekend at brunch. Don't Catholics have to do pre-Cana in order to be married in the church? I took another bite of eggs and ruffled Michael's hair. We'll get married in the church, I assured my Jewish fiancé. All of the religious stuff will sort itself out, I added, waving to the waiter for more pineapple juice. Every piece of my wedding did sort itself out, in fact, and that is because my mom and my sister sorted every single piece of it out for me. They're doing a great job, I thought to myself during a meeting about flowers. I pretended to listen to the florist for another few minutes, nodding at Carrie and pointing to a hydrangea. Through my disciplined practice of TM, I had reached a previously unknown plane of transcendental napping. I was able to fall asleep at a moment's notice, regardless of my surroundings and irrespective of my companions. I woke up calm, relaxed, and ready for another nap. Nirvana is your closest family and friends doing all of your work for you, I realized, no longer possessing the energy to do any of the wedding work myself. Ellie, you're drooling again, my instructor said with a sigh. I shook myself awake. Sorry, I murmured. I go deep, I explained, gathering my bags and leaving the complimentary refresher course that was included with the TM package I had originally purchased. When my wedding day finally arrived and all the suspense was finally over, I gave Michael a hug. We did it, I told him. I saw my mom and Carrie out of the corner of my eye and gave them a hang ten sign. Couldn't have done it without you, babes. They frowned. Everyone is out there waiting for you to cut the cake, my sister said, sighing. Why are you in the kitchen? She added wearily. Later that night, Michael's mom would see Paul McCartney as she walked back to her hotel in the rain. I would eat an entire large pizza, alone and in silence, watching the sun come up as Michael slept in his tuxedo. Leo Rusnak would wonder if I had been, in fact, the one that got away, and our photographer would privately remark to himself that he had never seen so much sweat on a bride's neck. As for my dance with transcendental meditation, it was slowing from a cha-cha to a waltz. The next week, the lights would go out in the ballroom completely. I found that I no longer needed to turn to TM to calm my mind. As a now wife, I found that tranquility by telling my husband everything that he does wrong instead. Look, I don't know why relationships work. I just know that ours does. Receptionist. My voice has not been described as warm or professional sounding as often as it has been described as please speak more quietly. So it is a testament to my skill as an actor that I successfully played a receptionist in an office for more than 4 years on NBC. How did you do it, Ellie? A lot of people have not asked me. Were the computers on set actually connected to the internet? More people want to know. Yes, the computers on the set of The Office were most definitely connected to the internet, and here are some of the items that I purchased while sitting in the background. A sky blue chevron rug from gilt.com. A Stanley 65-piece homeowner's tool set. Funny because there is a character on the show named Stanley, but the tool set had nothing to do with him. Tickets to numerous shows at the Upright Citizens Brigade on Franklin Avenue. My dinner order from Pime It's Thai to pick up on my way home from work. My dress for the 2011 Emmys. An antique horn grip corkscrew for my father-in-law. A framed map of San Francisco as a Christmas present for my little brother, Billy. Rainn Wilson could not believe that I bought such a lame, his word, gift for a 23-year-old man. Why don't you get him something that he would like? He demanded. I told Rain that not only did Billy live in San Francisco, but that I was also giving him the gift of latitude and longitude. It's never a bad idea to know where you are, I pointed out. Rain responded by showing me 8 new tech items that were popular at the time. Apple iPad Mini, Apple iPhone 5, Apple MacBook Pro, and 5 others that I would never be able to remember, and suggested that I purchase one of those for Billy instead. "You're an actress on a TV show," he told me. "Billy thinks you're a billionaire." I laughed and gave Rain a pat on the shoulder. The poor guy just couldn't understand that love and maps from the One Kings Lane clearance section were greater than money. A lot of other people asked me, did it feel like The Office was a masterclass in comedy? To these people I say, hey man, I don't go to your office and ask you if your job is a masterclass. But once those people are gone, I take off my thug facade and breathe a giant sigh of relief. To be totally honest, I knew what they were getting at. I was just acting tough in case they tried to rob me. How could a show like that not be a masterclass in comedy? And why is everyone in this paragraph so obsessed with using the term masterclass? In terms of comedy giants, I realize that the Dunder Mifflin fans out there will point to the usual suspects. Steve Carell, Mindy Kaling, Ed Helms, Jenna Fischer. But I would like to offer up 2 names with which you might not be as familiar. Lee Eisenberg and Gene Stubnitsky. These writer-producers from the show appeared in an episode called Cafe Disco, playing 2 Vance Refrigeration employees who spy Kelly and Aaron dancing together. The dialogue goes, Leo, played by Gene. There's girls in there. Gino, played by Lee. Where? Leo, the other room. Gino, what other room? Leo, down the hall. Gino, there's girls in there? Leo, what'd I just say? Gino, you get me my sandwich? Leo, forget the sandwich. Girls! Girls! And I've never seen 2 men more naturally funny than they are in that exchange. Anyway, Jim Carrey and Will Ferrell also made cameos on The Office, so yes, if it will stop your incessant questioning, you can call it a masterclass in comedy. The remaining people, the ones who have asked about neither the internet connection nor the masterclass, are several extended family members who feel the need to remind me periodically that they never watched The Office because it made them both cringe and feel car sick at the same time. I look at these extended family members, and I nod, and I tell them, yes, you have mentioned that before. And as I stick out my tongue at those family members once their backs are turned, I recall some of the great observations I made during my time on that show. Were these revelatory life lessons, sensible instructions for navigating a ruthless world, eternal wisdom that I would, in time, pass on to my descendants? They were not. Instead, they were the following truths that have no real practical application to daily life. 1. Only Steve Carell can touch the bagels. On my first day of work on The Office, I did not use serving tongs to select my bagel from the platter at craft service. I noticed that there weren't any serving tongs or spoons at craft service, so I selected the bagel with my eyes, and then I leaned forward to grab it with my hand. I was careful to touch only the bagel that I wanted, because I understood that touching the other bagels would be unsanitary. But at the same time that my hand had reached the sesame bagel of choice, another hand, a much larger hand, seized my own. I looked up, terrified. A powerfully built Armenian man was staring back at me. "You do not get to use your hands," he cried. "Only Steve Carell gets to use his hands." I swallowed hard. I wasn't sure who this man was, but his grip was fierce and his face was perspiring. "I'm so sorry," I squeaked. "I didn't see any tongs." The large hand pointed and the strong man frowned. "The tongs are at the end of the table," he shouted. I followed his gaze, and there, sure enough, were 4 black silicone serving tongs. This mighty gentleman with the bear-like paws had been right all along. I walked to the end of the table to get the tongs, but I wasn't sure what to do with them since I already had the sesame bagel in my hands. So I selected another bagel, this time a blueberry one, and put both bagels in a paper bowl because I did not see a plate. "Thank you so much," I said softly. I never once saw Steve Carell eat a bagel. I only ever saw him quietly take his place at the end of the lunch line most afternoons. But the bagel man's point was that if Steve Carell ever did choose to eat a bagel, he would enjoy the unique privilege of not needing to bother with the tongs. In the world of show business, even hygiene is a status game, and only when you ascend to the level of national treasure do you earn the distinction of being allowed to touch food with your bare hands. P.S. The so-called bagel man was Vartan Shakirian, the head of craft service. After such an intense first encounter, the two of us would go on to become good friends. 2. Bryan Cranston is not the same person as Walter White. I went to see my first musical, Oklahoma, live on stage at the St. Louis Fox Theater when I was 8 years old. I couldn't believe that the dark, brooding villain of the show, a loner named Judd Fry, received a standing ovation when he came out for his bow. But he was the bad guy, I protested to my mom. I refused to stand up, and I even stopped clapping my own hands. My mom laughed. We are applauding the actor, not the character, she told me. The actor did a tremendous job. I agreed with myself to disagree with my mom and continued to sit in my seat until I saw that I had dropped 2 peanut M&Ms on the floor. Then I was finally forced to get out of my seat to bend down and reach for the candy so that I could bring it to my face and eat it. But clap for that evil man was something I would never do. History repeated itself when brilliant chameleon actor Bryan Cranston came to direct the 4th episode of the 9th season of The Office. I had not started watching Breaking Bad until the show was in its 3rd season, but I had spent the late summer of 2012 largely in its grasp. This show is as addictive as the meth it is about, I whispered to my husband. I wasn't intentionally trying to be as insightful as a paid television critic, but I can't always stop these gems from slipping out of my mouth. We can all agree that the show is incredible, and Walter White is an anti-hero for the ages. So when I saw Bryan Cranston walk onto the Dunder Mifflin parking lot set in early fall, I nearly fainted. I knew that Walter White was a complicated man, neither all bad nor all good. But still, this drug baron was about to take my character and tell her where to stand and when to answer the phone, and I was terrified. He greeted our cast and crew with a friendly, "Morning, guys!" But I knew not to fall into his trap. "Your smile can't fool me," I remember thinking. I was so scared he was going to offer me crystal meth. "Just keep me away from the blue sky," I muttered to myself. "You keep that blue magic away from me," I added, using an alternate name for Walter White and Jesse Pinkman's signature blue and notoriously potent pure crystal methamphetamine. "Baby don't want no blue," I shouted at my own reflection in a nearby prop car. "Who are you talking to?" Brian Baumgartner, who played Kevin, asked. The title of Bryan Cranston's episode was Work Bus, but all the cast had secretly nicknamed it Death Bus. The reason we had given the episode this nickname is that we all nearly died on the bus. I cannot emphasize strongly enough that our collective near-death experience had nothing to do with Bryan Cranston. It didn't even have to do with drug trafficking. It had to do with the brakes temporarily not working and the bus flying off the side of the road. I remember falling out of my seat and feeling grateful that I no longer had to come up with an excuse for having wet my pants several minutes earlier. There is a part in Work Bus where Jim is leading a song called Shabuya Roll Call, and I had gotten a case of the giggles during this song, a case so severe that I eventually peed through my pantyhose and onto my skirt. Anyway, now I could just blame the urine stains on the impact of the bus crash. The cast survived the bus flying off the road and, if anything, was made stronger because of it. But I also felt unexpectedly proud now that Walter White could see how tough we all were. Up until then, we had shot only interior scenes in the office bullpen. But now, we were out in the wild, wild west, baby. Try and mess with us now, Walter White! I do want to mention here that kind, delightful Bryan Cranston is in no way like Walter White, and that I did give him a standing ovation after all the way. 3. During downtime on a set, only make small talk if absolutely necessary. Because I had never worked on anything longer than a commercial or a comedy sketch before joining the cast of The Office, I was unaware of just how much time on a film set is spent waiting. You are sitting and waiting, or standing and waiting, or eating and waiting. The one constant is that you are waiting. It's unfair that actors get paid to wait, and other people actually have to do work in order to get paid, but here it might be helpful to remember that actors are more valuable than everyone else in the world. During these wait times, which happen as a result of lighting setups or script changes or costume malfunctions or a baby that has been written into the episode and won't stop crying, which is why I really don't think babies should be on television, guys, people will start to chat with one another. This is natural and to be expected. And one thing I often compliment myself on is my ability to keep a conversation going. But as is the case with most talents on which I compliment myself, picking out ripe avocados, sight-reading basic piano tunes, canceling and then rescheduling appointments, this one has a drawback. Avocado goes bad by end of day, basic piano tunes are boring piano tunes, eventually have to go to appointment anyway. Sometimes the conversation doesn't end. This is a problem because I will often wander into strange, undesirable conversational territory and find myself getting entangled in the vines of the trees that grow there. I can't always seem to get myself out of the vines, and then I am horrified to discover that, on top of everything else, I'm standing on quicksand! So, I'm tangled up, sinking, and still trying as hard as I can to explain, for some reason, why my sister-in-law's brother's favorite book is Emma, with no help in sight. Once, I was standing next to Kate Flannery, who played Meredith, while our camera guys adjusted some lights in the accounting area. I had some old hand warmers in my coat pocket from a few days earlier when we'd been filming outside. I should also explain that actresses get much colder than all other people when filming outside and are often offered those air-activated hand and foot warmers by the wardrobe department. This is a relief because otherwise the actresses would get even colder. The hand warmers had long ago gone cold and hard. That's what she said, guys. And I mentioned to Kate how I kept reaching into my pockets and thinking they were old Kleenex. Actually, I said, taking one of the hand warmers out to examine it, it really looks like an old maxi pad. Kate laughed and, encouraged, I continued, or at least a panty liner. Then Steve Carell walked up to us and asked how our days were going. I turned to Steve Carell and welcomed him into our group. Then, because I see silence as an enemy, I started talking again. Kate and I were just saying how much this old hand warmer looks like a maxi pad, I shared with Steve Carell. He nodded. Oh, he said, I guess it does. The camera guys finished the lighting setup just then, and our assistant director Kelly called everyone to places. I walked away from Steve Carell and Kate and decided I should probably just throw the old hand warmers away so nobody would ever have to talk about them again. 4. Number 18 on the call sheet really means number 18 on the call sheet. For those listeners out there unfamiliar with the term call sheet, this is the piece of paper on a television or film production that tells you what scenes are being shot that day and in what order. In addition, it contains all the names and job titles of the cast and crew involved that day, and usually includes a cute mini weather report with little sun or thunderstorm icons as well. The actors are numbered, frankly, in order of status. The lead actor is number one, and the rest of the cast falls into line according to either the size of their part, the point in the production timeline at which they joined, or a typo from a production assistant working on the call sheet. When I joined the office at the end of season 5, I was assigned number 18 on the call sheet. I can vote, I joked to our security guard, Joseph. Because I'm 18, I quickly explained. Joseph got it the first time and smiled. But you can't drink, he added, laughing. I then tried to think of another unique feature of being 18 years old, but I don't think there are any. In high school, Aiko Ito's mom used to cheer on our field hockey team from the sidelines. Go Ellie, she would shout. Number 25 on the field, number 1 in our hearts. She would shout out this catchphrase to all the players, so you had to know that you weren't actually number 1 in everyone's hearts. How could all 16 women simultaneously be number 1? But it made you feel pretty great when you were out on the field. Because there are more than 20 cast members on the office and only 6 people to do all our hair and makeup, I was called in very early to get ready. The actors lower down on the call sheet generally had less work to do during the day, and this schedule allowed the actors higher up on the call sheet to spend less time waiting around to shoot. In those dark hours before dawn, driving north on the 101 in a charcoal Ford Fusion rental, I recalled Mrs. Ito's words. You might be number 18 on the call sheet, I psyched myself up over the smooth chatter of Lakshmi Singh, but you are number 1 in their hearts. And yet, sometimes even I fell victim to the temptation to whine. One evening on the way home from Van Nuys, I complained to my mom on the phone. It's really insane, I told her. This morning, I was called in for hair and makeup at 5:30 a.m., and I didn't even shoot anything until 11. My mom was silent. Anyway, I'm exhausted, I went on. I've been up a long time. My mom paused one more moment before speaking. The job you have is insane, she agreed. The job you have is a job most people only dream about having. I knew then that my mother could never, ever understand how difficult my life was. Scratch that. My mom was right. 5. One weird meeting might lead to a failed audition, which might lead to a better audition. My first meeting with the producers from the office was in the fall of 2008, a couple of months after I had auditioned for Saturday Night Live. Sharon Jackson, my agent extraordinaire, had set a meeting for me with Greg Daniels and Mike Schur, the executive producers and writers of The Office. I remember that I wore a blue, short-sleeved dress from Anthropology that didn't not make me look like a French cartoon. I met with Greg first, and then Mike joined about 10 minutes later. There are only 2 chairs in Greg's office, and gallant Mike Schur just sort of crouched on the floor. They told me that they were developing a new show, and at one point, the actor Creed Bratton walked in to get a Coke. A few weeks after that meeting, I was called back to the offices of The Office to read with Allison Jones, the casting director, for a part on this new untitled show written by Greg and Mike. I did not receive a full script, only the scenes that I would be reading, and I was not sure what the show was about. My character's name was Donna. Greg was also in the room, and after the audition, he told me to feel free to use the audition space to prepare for my one-woman show, which he knew I was performing that night at the UCB. A few weeks after that, my manager called me to tell me that, sadly, I had not gotten the part. "What part?" I asked. "The part that you read for Allison Jones," he told me. "The part of Donna." "But what was that show?" I asked him. "And who is Donna?" "It's a new show," he told me. "Donna is a character in the show." I paused. I took a deep breath. "I thought that was like a general audition," I admitted. Now it was my manager who paused. "You know what I mean," I continued. "A sort of overall audition to show people what I can do, in general." I laughed, but it came out as a sob. "Ellie," my manager said gently, "there is no such thing as a general audition." The show was Parks and Recreation, and a character named Donna would eventually be played by the actress and comedian Retta. I'm still not sure if that is the part that I was auditioning for, or if they just ended up naming a different character Donna. But in any case, I am not Donna. I am, however, using that as the title for my debut indie rock album. Mark my words, "I am not Donna" will give clarity to a generation. A few months after the Donna audition, I got the audition for Kelly on The Office. This was originally a 4-episode arc, and the character would later go by her middle name, Erin, since The Office already had a Kelly, Kapoor. But names don't really matter here. What matters here is that I had my audition for The Office on the same day that I had 2 other auditions, one for a pilot by Adam Resnick called Cop House, and the other for an American adaptation of a British comedy called Pulling. This meant that all my nerves were shared among 3 different auditions instead of just one. Also, the logistics of getting from one place to another almost gave me a heart attack. I would go from The Office in Van Nuys to Cop House in Beverly Hills to Pulling in Century City. These 3 sections of Los Angeles are not close to one another, and I'm a terrible driver who has no sense of the dimensions of either her own car or those cars around her. So, channeling my anxious energy into driving, navigating, and not sweating through that same blue Anthropology French cartoon dress left me uncharacteristically calm for the auditions themselves. My first audition of the 3 was for The Office, and I read 2 scenes with Ed Helms. I remembered all my lines perfectly, which usually doesn't happen because I get nervous in auditions. But Ed is one of the most welcoming people on the planet, and though I had never met him before, we had some improv friends in common, and we talked about them for a bit before the audition. This both put me at ease and also reminded me that I am pretty bad at keeping in touch with friends. We went through the scene 2 times, and my only note was to ice out Andy more. See, when the show first introduces Erin, she's pretty chill. She has brown hair, she's good at her job, and she's cool. As the show goes on, Erin evolves into a redheaded rube who has trouble answering the phone correctly. But at the time of the audition, the character was smooth and competent. My other agent extraordinaire, Priyanka Matu, called me a few days after the audition to tell me that I'd gotten a part. I could not believe it. The odds of booking a role on any show anywhere are so small, and this was a show that I happened to worship. I felt like dancing, but instead I ordered a BLT pizza from Pizzeria Mozza, extra bacon. I did not receive callbacks for Cop House or Pulling, but I did dent a car in the Wendy O'Brien casting parking lot while trying to turn into a spot at the wrong angle. After my arc was supposed to have ended, the writers kept Pam, the previous receptionist, as a salesperson. This meant that Dunder Mifflin still needed a replacement receptionist, and in June, after we wrapped, I received a contract for 7 more seasons on The Office. This was a standard network television contract. There ended up being only 4 more seasons. I knew then that I definitely needed to take some sort of driving refresher course. 7 years would mean a lot of dented cars otherwise, and I just wasn't ready for that kind of drama. 6. There ain't no party like a Scranton party, because a Scranton party don't stop. After we finished filming the final episode of The Office in the spring of 2013, our entire cast and a bunch of the crew were invited to a parade and citywide celebration.